Okay.
So, let's continue where we were. We did the first verse, the first two lines last time. Respectfully, I pay homage to the Suggatas who are endowed with the Dharmakaya, as well as to their heirs, the Bodhisattvas, who are all, and to all who are worthy of homage. Okay, so to remember that all who are worthy to homage includes the arhats, our teachers, all people who we can possibly learn from. Okay, and so this thing of this expression of reverence sets our, or Shanti's Deva is doing this, but it's also for us to set the framework, the attitude with which we're going to approach the text. So it's not one in which, well, I know this already, and let's see what the Suggatas have to say about it. Okay, it's one in which we really have reverence and confidence and trust in the three jewels, and we're approaching the text in that way. So that's a certain kind of mindset. It's not a mindset that's cynical. It's not a mindset that's looking to pick at faults. It's not a mindset full of doubt or skepticism. Okay. And so it's how Shanti Deva's preparing his mind, but we want to also prepare our minds with a similar kind of attitude. Then the third line of the first verse says, here I shall describe how to engage in the vows or the practices of the Suggatas' heirs. Okay, so the Bodhisattvas. So this is the primary focus of the book. Yeah, how to follow in the path of the Bodhisattvas so we can become fully awakened Buddhas. And so last week I explained how that covers the whole path, starting with the initial level practitioner, the medium level, and the advanced level practitioner. Okay, so learn that outline, yeah, of the practices that you do to generate this particular motivation, and then the practices you do to actualize what that motivation is. Because if you have that in your mind, then it will really help you not to become confused when you have different teachings. Mm-hmm. Okay, then the fourth line of the first verse is about, well, it says the meaning of which. Okay, so engaging in the practices of the Suggatas' children, the meaning of which I have summarized in accordance with the scriptures. So here he's saying, in the third line, he identified the topic he's going to talk about. And here he's saying, this is not something I'm making up. Okay, so it's something that's said in the scriptures, and I'm summarizing it according to the scriptures. So somebody, you know, Gyaltso Jay talks about in his thing. Let me see. So somebody says, okay, so here, you know how through all the texts, we have people who make objections. Jeffrey translates it as objection, okay? The Tibetan term is kachik. It means one mouth. Okay, so somebody with a mouth who is either an opponent and disagrees, or they have a viable question and they want to ask it. Okay, so somebody says, if Shanti Deva composed the treatise for the purpose of himself, if he did not understand it, then he was unsuitable to compose the treatise. You know, so he just, you know, gave this reason. Actually, this is coming with the next. Let me just go read the next. I'm sorry, I'm jumping ahead. That's for the third verse. Let's go back to where we were. Okay. Okay, sorry. I was too easy to quote one mouth. We'll come back to him. Okay, so he's saying that it's not a teaching that he made up. So this is very important, because as we know, looking at the New Age newspapers in town, every week there's somebody who has invented a path to awakening, and it's all yours for the special price of $99.99, okay? And it's going to be quick, cheap, and easy, and somebody made it up last night or the night before, or maybe they took a little bit from a bunch of different things, and he did what Lama Yeshe calls making soup. So you take different beliefs and different practices, you know, like taking carrots and potatoes and broccoli and mixing it all together, and you have your spiritual soup. Okay, but Shantideva is saying, no, I didn't do this. I'm taking this straight from the Buddhist scriptures. Okay. So then in the second verse, he says, there is nothing here that has not appeared in the past, and I have no skill in the art of rhetoric. Okay, so here he is expressing humility, you know, and he's, you know, getting into his whole motivation for why he's writing this. Okay, so he's saying there's nothing here that hasn't appeared in the past. So I'm not making any of this up. If you look closely in the scriptures before, you're going to find everything I say there. Okay, so he's completely diminishing his own importance. He's not making a big deal of, you know, I have found the secret in the Buddha scriptures that none of the past sages have found, and now I'm going to explain it to you fortunate ones, you know, and here's the offering dish. He's not doing that, okay? So he's saying it's all there. Somebody said it all before. And he's saying, you know, because somebody may think, okay, well, somebody said it before, but you're doing it because you want to write it and make it sound like nice poetry and nice something, you know, because you're a big shot. And he says, and I have no skill in the art of rhetoric. So I'm not doing this because I'm a fantastic poet or writer. And, you know, in fact, he's implying I'm doing this in spite of not being a good writer. So now he's getting into why he's inspired to compose the text. He says, therefore, not to enact the welfare of others, I compose this in order to acquaint it to my mind. Okay, so he's saying I'm not a bodhisattva, but you choose whether you believe him or not. So I'm not trying to enact the welfare of others. I'm writing this because I need to familiarize my mind with it. Yeah. So again, he's being quite humble, and he's also saying, you know, I need to familiarize my mind with this. And here he is, the person writing the text. So if he needs to familiarize his mind with it, what does that say about us? We need to also familiarize our mind. So we shouldn't approach this text with, well, I've heard this teaching before. Why do I have to listen to it again? I want to hear something new. Okay. So this is an attitude that it's very easy to come by when you've been around the Dharma for a while. Okay, when you're new, everything's new. You haven't heard it, you want to hear it. It's like diamonds, and you can't believe how wonderful it is. And then after a while, it's, I've heard the Lama hymn so many times. I've heard the meditation on death. You talked about it then, you talked about it here. Why do I have to listen? In precious human life, oh my goodness, yes, I'm not born in the hells and I'm not born in the end. Yeah, so what? You know, and we have this attitude of, well, I've heard this all before. Why do I need to hear it again? That kind of attitude shows exactly why we need to hear it again. Okay? Because the mind that says, oh, I've got this all down pat, and is just kind of treating the Dharma like old hat, is showing that we haven't really gotten the beauty and the meaning of what is being told to us. Because when it really goes in our heart, because of familiarization, then there's this real sense of appreciation. And every time you hear the same teaching, you know you're going to hear it at a different level and it's going to mean something different to you. Okay? So, you know, this is something very important. I remember being in Dharamsala and, you know, some people, you know, His Holiness would teach the Lam Rim text, and a few people would say, oh, I've heard that so many times before, I'm not going to go. Yeah? But who goes to those teachings? All the Geshe's, all the Rinpoches, all the Lamas, you know, all the people who teach the text themselves go to listen when His Holiness is there. So they surely know the text inside and out. They probably have it memorized. But they go and listen when their teacher teaches it. Why? Yeah. Are they going just to be polite? Because they think His Holiness is going to be mad if they don't show up? You know, I don't think that's the reason, you know. It's because every time you hear something, it goes in a different way and it impacts you in a different way. Yeah. And, you know, people are always saying, oh, I practice and I haven't had any realizations or even strong experiences. But how do you get strong experiences in your meditation? It's through the process of familiarization. It's through the process of doing the practice many times when you don't have a strong experience because your mind is distracted or whatever. It's the process of doing it many, many times that's what brings the depth so that one day you go, oh, is that what they're talking about? And then you think, oh, now I've got it completely. Yeah. But if you keep meditating on it, yeah, then later you may hear the teaching again and go, oh, I didn't realize that before. And again, you know, it goes into your mind deeper in a way that it hadn't before. Okay? So if your teacher is teaching it, it's very good to go. If it's not somebody who's your teacher, there's no requirement to go. But if it is, you know, something where the conditions are there whereby, you know, you can really listen with intention and attention and focus, then, you know, good to go. And even you've heard it before, even if you can recite the text along with the Lama, yeah? So he's saying, you know, I'm not trying to help others and I'm doing this to acquaint my own mind with it. Okay, so he's really diminishing his importance. But then he adds, you know, for due to the acquaintance with virtue, the force of my faith will for the time being increase because of these. Okay, so here in the third verse, he's saying, you know, I have some acquaintance with virtue and there's the force of my faith in the Buddha. And so, therefore, by familiarizing my mind with this, something will increase in my mind. So then the last two lines of verse 3 say, You know, so he said, I'm doing it basically for myself, okay? But then he says, you know, if, however, those, what I'm writing is seen by others equal in fortune to myself, it will be meaningful. So I'm writing it primarily to familiarize my own mind, but there may be other people who are interested in this topic, who have thought about it like I am, who are equal in fortune and have faith. And if they read it, this may also mean something valuable to them. Yeah, so primarily for myself, but incidentally for others. Okay, now One Mouth says, okay, if Shantideva composed the treatise for the purpose of self, then if he did not understand the treatise, understand the meaning already, then he was unsuitable to compose the treatise. So if he didn't already understand the meaning, how could he write the text? Yeah. And if he understood it, then of course that itself is enough to meditate on. So what need is there to compose the text? So if he didn't understand it, he's unqualified to read it. If he did understand it, he should be meditating on it. He doesn't need to write it down already because he's already understood it. Okay. So this is the kind of questions that Kachik asks. Okay. So Shantideva's reply via channeling, Gelsabjai apparently channeled him, said, I composed the treatise to familiarize my mind in an uninterrupted manner with the extensive virtue that I entered into earlier. Okay, so I learned this earlier, but now I want to sit down and really focus on it in an uninterrupted way. By putting it in the form of the treatise, it also increases this mind more and more. So it deepens my understanding. Hence, by composing this treatise through the force of my faith, wisdom, and compassion, initially all these in my continuum increase. Okay, so he's talking about the qualities that he has, you know, that are going to make writing this text valuable for him, that are the same qualities we need to make listening to it valuable for us. So faith, you know, in the Buddha's teachings, and remember, faith doesn't mean blind faith. It's faith based on conviction, based on learning. So you've done some study and practice before. You trust what the Buddha's said. Wisdom, so you're willing to investigate the meaning of the teachings and see if they hold true. And compassion, so you're listening with a mind of compassion for all beings. You're not, you know, he's not writing it with a mind trying to get fame, and we're not listening to it with a mind trying to learn something so we can become famous. Okay. So hence, then in dependence on that, on all of that for myself, okay, others of equal fortune to see this treatise will also understand. Yeah, so people who are doing what I'm doing at about the same level, they'll read it, they'll understand, they'll benefit. Okay. So that kind of Kachik out of the way for a little bit. He'll come again. But Kachik's good, you know? The person who asks these kind of questions, they bring up points that we may never have thought about. And by bringing out these points, even if they're straw men that Shantideva's created, there's not really anybody asking this question, but he's making up somebody to ask the question, it helps Shantideva to clarify a point that he's trying to make. Okay. So don't take all the objections as, you know, these are just obnoxious people who want to interrupt. They very often raised very good points that it's good for us to pay attention to. Okay, then we are moving on to the actual explanation of the stages of the path. So first is we're going to talk about precious human life, because that will inspire us to take the essence of this basis of a precious human life and really use it. So this comes at the very beginning of the Lamrim too. In the Lamrim, the first meditation is relying on the spiritual mentor. Then you have precious human life. Here he starts out with precious human life. Okay. Yeah. Why start out with, you know, how to create a relationship with the teacher in Lamrim? You know, because, I mean, some people want to start out with that because it helps people to get set up, get established, figure out how to relate to a spiritual mentor. But then other people prefer actually to put the meditation about the guru at the end, after people have been exposed to the teachings and check the teachings out. And when they've done that, then seeing the qualities of the guru and how to set up a relationship with a spiritual mentor that's productive, then that makes a whole lot of sense. You know, with new people in the West, starting out with the meditation on the guru, I don't think that works so well. Okay, it's extremely confusing for people. You can see, you know, you ask, well, why did Tsongkhapa start out like that, you know? Well, because he was writing for people who had already done, you know, the Geshe studies, and he was picking out the important points for them so that they could go meditate on it. So he wasn't talking to newbies. We get the Lamrim as total newbies, yeah, but we're not the audience that Tsongkhapa or, you know, or Pabongka Rinpoche or whoever else was really addressing, yeah. So for those people, yes, how to relate to a spiritual mentor to start out with makes sense. But for us, there needs to be a lot of other topics, which is one reason for writing the Library of Wisdom and Compassion, to put a lot of that information early on, okay? Then you're going to say, but why in the Library of Wisdom and Compassion did you put relating to a spiritual mentor in volume 2? That's fairly early on, you know, if you're going to have 10 or 11 volumes. How come you put it so early? Well, it's because it's been such a confusing topic for new people, especially people in the West. And so as a way of really explaining what this topic is and the different levels of spiritual mentor and how you think about each, the mentors of the different levels, how you relate to these mentors, what to do when there's a difference of opinion, you know, what kind of expectations to have. So it's in order to clarify a lot of the difficulties that have arisen in people's minds before. That's why it was put in volume 2. Okay, so here we're going into precious human life. So verse 4. The leisures and endowments are very hard to find, since they accomplish the purposes of beings. If I do not accomplish benefit upon this, how will I acquire this in the future? Okay, so I'm reading one translation here. If we have next time have the Bachelor's translation, I might just read from it because I find it a little bit easier. Oh, is that an... Are those extra copies? Yeah? I don't want to deprive you of what you're using. Okay, so here it says, leisure and endowment, which I translate as freedom and fortune, You know, why? Leisure. I hear the word leisure. The first thing, leisure world. Do you remember leisure world? It's a retirement community. Yeah? In America, at least it was when I was a little kid, there were all these ads for Leisure World. So I hear you have leisure, and I think of, you know, a retirement community. And endowments, that's what universities have, you know? So, you know, am I going to a retirement community with a university with an endowment, or they're trying, because I'm older, going to get me to make a contribution to their endowment? So that's why I said freedom and fortune, okay? Because, you know, it sounds poetically better. And to me, it's just, yeah. Okay, thank you. So freedom, because we're free from 8 undesirable conditions that create obstacles for us, and fortune, because there are, you know, 10 good conditions that we have. So, okay, freedom and fortune are very hard to find, and since they accomplish what is meaningful for humanity. Okay, so why do we have to learn about freedom and fortune? Because, you know, with them, we accomplish what is meaningful for humanity. Yeah. If I do not take advantage of these conditions now, how will such a perfect opportunity come about again? Okay. So I won the lottery. If I don't invest what I won, you know, but I fritter it away, then I'm going to wind up right back where I started from, okay? So, in Gyaltsebji's commentary, he then quotes a verse from Nagarjuna's letter to a friend that talks about the freedoms and fortunes, okay? So here's how it's listed. So holding wrong views and birth as an animal, hungry ghost or hell being, without the conqueror's teachings and birth as a barbarian in a border country and being deaf and dumb. Okay. So holding wrong views. So I was thinking about this one this morning, and you know, we so often think, oh, all these people, you know, they have wrong views. But after you die, you know, there's nothing, or they believe in all these, you know, philosophies that don't make much sense. You know, these people must be really kind of dumb and awful. Well, I don't know about you, but if I look in my life, I've held a bunch of wrong views in my life, and held them for strongly and for a long period of time. Yeah, so I was brought up, you know, taught to believe in God. So as a kid, I believed in God, and I prayed to God, and I tried to do that whole thing, okay? When that didn't work for me, then I, you know, decided I didn't believe in any God, and you know, that after I die, there's, you know, we die, there's nothing, you know, it's darkness, we go out of existence. And so, you know, because I studied science in school too, so, you know, what's all this stuff, heaven and hell, and God sends you to heaven and hell, you know, it sounds like a fairy tale. So you die, just get used to it, kid, you're nothing, okay? And I held those views for a number of years. Okay, what about you? Did any of you hold wrong views for a period in your life? Yeah? Now, what would have happened if you had continued to hold those same views over a period of time? How would that have changed how you lived? How would that have changed the decisions you made? Okay, if you, like me, you know, continued to believe in a creator, Then probably, you know, your practice would be keeping the commandments, okay? And all religion, beside the Ten Commandments, there's all these, you know, detailed ones that you're supposed to keep too. So probably being quite ritualistic, yeah? Doing a lot of worship, yeah? And what else? Yeah, would you have learned about emptiness? Would you have learned about bodhicitta? You would have heard teachings, or we would have heard teachings, about love thy neighbor as thyself, but nobody telling you how to do it. Yeah. That for me was one of the big things when I became a Buddhist, is somebody told me how to develop these qualities instead of just love thy neighbor as thyself. Well, first of all, I didn't love myself that much. Second of all, you know, why should I love all these other people? Because some of them are real nincompoops, you know? I'd never look that up in the dictionary. I hope it's not an offensive word to somebody. I should probably look it up so I don't offend someone. But, you know, yeah. And if I had gone through the rest of my life not believing in any kind of religious system, that when you die, you die, how would that have affected my ethical conduct? Yeah. Would it have made me, would I have started to think about the results of my actions? Well, I probably would have in terms of the results that they bring this life. So maybe I would have the attitude of don't do anything that breaks the law unless you can do it without getting caught. Okay. But if you can do it without getting caught, why not? Because it's not going to have any far-reaching effects. And especially, you know, if you're cheating companies out of their money or something, they have tons of money anyway. And, you know, so why not do these kinds of things? And if I can lie and prevent, not hurt somebody, you know, which is how I always justified my lying, then why not? Huh? And why not kill all the bugs? Yeah, they're real pests and annoying, so I should just do it. So, you know, think about it. If you were somebody with wrong views and you never met the Dharma, yeah, what kind of karma would you have created the rest of this life, and what kind of rebirth would you have as a result of that karma? Okay. So think about this and then think, oh, how fortunate I am now that I've met the Buddha's teachings. They make sense to me. I have conviction in them. And I'm letting them influence my life and influence how I think and what I say and how I act. Okay? And so then you come to appreciate why it's good to, you know, not be born as somebody holding wrong views. Okay. And then birth is an animal. So the kitties are listening to the teachings. Yeah. Yeah. Did you wake up? So again, I mean, the kitties are real Dharma teachers for us, aren't they? They clearly have some good karma to be born sitting here. I mean, look at Karuna in this. She's sitting on her throne with comfy cushions in a warm place, and everybody pampers her. Yeah. But she can't understand anything that's being said. So she has no obstacles with getting to teachings. But once she's there, she can't understand anything, you know. And as much as we tell the kiddies, you know, not to chase gophers, not to kill bugs. They don't listen to us. You know, when my tree starts growling in here, as much as we say, you don't need to, nothing bad is going to happen, she can't understand. Yeah. So, you know, it's good. Sometime in your meditation, imagine being one of the kitties at the Abbey. And what's your mind going to be like? What are you thinking about all day? Food, sleep, and getting petted when you want to be petted and not when you don't want to be petted. Yeah. And that's basically what your what goes on in your mind. Now, how, you know, if you had that kind of rebirth, how would you create virtue? How would you purify non-virtue? Yeah? You live, you have all this comfort, then you die, then some other karma ripens. Yeah? But unless a few of the nuns have taken you around the stupa, you know, the statue of the Buddha, a few times and helped you plant good imprints in your mind, or, you know, you've been here at teaching, so some imprints of the teachings are in. Yeah, which is good in a future life, you know, if they hear teachings, it'll sound hopefully pleasant. But will they have the karma to fall asleep all the time in the teachings or to be growling at somebody next to them in the teachings? Okay. So just, you know, put your, you know, in this meditation, you really have to pretend that you have another life and think, you know, how would I practice? What would it be? And having being born as a kitty in the Abbey, you're fortunate, you know. Imagine being born a donkey in Dharamsala. Yeah. Imagine being born one of those pigs in Iowa who are getting squished together and now killed, either to be eaten or because they don't know what else to do with them because they can't get the meat to the market. And you have no choice in your life. Your life is completely governed by human beings who see you as property and just want to make money, and they don't care if you suffer or not. Yeah, so we're free from that kind of situation. That's a relief, isn't it? Yeah. Who wants to be born as an animal? Then hungry ghost. So hungry ghosts have a mind. Yeah. That our minds go into sometimes hungry ghost-like minds, except their mind is completely obsessed like this. I don't have what I want. I gotta get something. It's the mind of dissatisfaction. The mind of greed, you know, except in hungry ghosts, you know, they're not wanting Mercedes and things like that. They're just trying to get what they need to stay alive. You know, they want food. They want water. They can't find it. They see it in the distance. Oh, there it is. I'm going to run towards it. And they get there and the water is a mirage and the food is garbage that they can't eat. Or they find some food and they put it in their mouth, but they can't swallow it because their neck is so thin. Or they're able to swallow it and it burns all the way down. Or it manages to get to their stomach and their stomach erupts. You know? So there, you know, it's described in a very physical way. And, you know, the hungry ghost has that kind of that kind of physical problem. But the mind behind it that's never satisfied, always running here and there, I want this, I want that. This has to be done exactly the way I want it. the noodles have to be cooked exactly this way. Not hard noodles, not mushy noodles, exactly this way. You know? Then please cook them that way. So, you know, this is how you create the karma for a hungry ghost rebirth, you know. And it's like people in relationships. Yeah, Liz Taylor was married 8 times. A few of those were to the same guy. I can't remember. Didn't she marry? Richard Burton. How many times did she marry him? Two or three times, yeah. And Eddie Fisher, just once? I don't know. I never kept track.
That really dates you.
Yeah, well, it all dates me. I'm not going to pretend to be other than what I am. Okay. I'm a boomer and I'm proud of it. Okay, you can still say "Hey, boomer" to me, though. It's okay. I won't get offended.
Venerable boomer.
Okay. Okay. So, people who are going from one relationship to the next, one job to the next, one thing to the next, you know, there's never any satisfaction, you know. The chanting, or monastics going one teacher to the next until they find a teacher who tells them what they want to hear. Yeah. So you find people like that. Okay. So, I mean, if you're a hungry ghost, how are you going to practice the Dharma? That's going to be hard. Yeah. I mean, you can't even eat and drink and you're running around all day. And imagine, if you like to complain, if you're a hungry ghost, you get to complain all day and all night. And is that going to make you happy?
Someone is asking, are hungry ghosts the same thing as ghosts, poltergeists, spirits that we might encounter?
Now, I'm not an expert on all of this kind of stuff. They talk about 8 different kinds of spirit beings and so on. Some of them, Nagas are in the animal realm. Gandharvas, I think, are in the Asura realm. Some of them are in the hungry ghost realm. So it's in Abhidharma Kosha. You can look it up, yeah. But different kinds of beings, yeah. Okay. And then, or hell beings, so we're free of being born as with wrong views, as an animal. Imagine being a hungry ghost and then come back to being a human again. And like, what a relief. Yeah, how much better situation you have. And then a hell being. Yeah, a hell being where, again, it's described in terms of physical torture. But I could think of a hell realm with mental torture too. Yeah. Where, you know, you're just, you can read all about the hell realms, but I won't go into them. But, you know, incredible physical pain. There's one hell realm where your loved ones are on top of the tree and you want to go up to them. So you climb the tree, but the tree all along the trunk of the tree and the leaves are their blades that are focused down. So as you're climbing to try and get to your loved ones, you're getting cut up. When you get up there, it isn't your loved ones. There it's a facsimile. You're trying to get down again. This time the blades go up, so you're getting cut, you know, this way. They suffer from heat. They suffer from cold. So again, if you're in a state of great physical suffering like that, are you going to be able to practice the Dharma? Yeah. I mean, we get a cold and we can't even practice. Yeah. We get a cold and we're in a comfy bed with a hot water bottle with people bringing us food and we still can't practice. How in the world are we going to practice if we're born in a hell realm? You know? So this is why it's, you know, now as human beings, we have to develop some ability to go through hardship. Yeah. So that hardship doesn't destroy us. Otherwise, let alone being born in a hell realm, if we're born as a human being with a lot of suffering, it'll totally overwhelm us. We won't be able to practice. Yeah. We can kind of see that, you know. Sometimes I stand back and I look at America and I look at other countries and the cultures in different places. Americans are, they don't want to experience hardship. We've never had a war on this land, except for the wars that the white people fought against the Native Americans. We've had plenty of violence and, of course, the Civil War, but never being invaded like that. Yeah. Europe has had that experience, many experiences like that. I think they're a little bit more cautious about going to war. Yeah. Because they have more understanding of what war brings. For Americans, it's, you know, a war is always happens somewhere else. Okay, our soldiers have to go there and they die. But it's never the civilians. It's never, you know, the cities where fighting is happening. And especially now, you know, the Americans of the previous centuries who built the country up, they went through a lot of hardship, okay? I mean, certainly the enslaved people went through hardship. The immigrants went through hardship, yeah? A lot of people went through hardship coming here with nothing, you know, as refugees, immigrants, slaves, whatever. But since World War II and the economic boom, you know, nobody's really used to hardship. The hardship people are talking about now is, you know, the millennials graduate from college and they can't find a job. But that's such a different kind of hardship than, you know, people have gone through to just secure their ability to stay alive. So we aren't good at hardship. Yeah, and bearing it. We're very good at complaining. We're very good at, this is my right, and I need to get my way because it's my right. Yeah, but the feeling of we're all in this together and we've got to work together, like I said yesterday, how sweet I found it, Prince Philip asking all the British to go and pick lettuce and fruit and acknowledging this is not a glamorous job, you know, and it's not a well-paying job, but we've got to come together and do it for the benefit of everybody, like we work together in the war, you know, and he could say that. And here, you know, our president won't say anything like that. And even if he did, to what extent would people listen? Yeah. So, you know, that's the way it is. Now, talking on an individual basis, as an individual, do we want to be like that? Or do we want to build up some resiliency, some ability to deal with setbacks, with harm, with hardship? Yeah, so that we aren't just overwhelmed by suffering. And this is where the teachings on taking the harm into the path, the mind training teachings. This is where they're so valuable and so important, and why we need to hear those teachings and then put them into practice. Yeah. Instead of just, well, this will never happen to me, so I'm not going to think about it. Or if it happens, then I'll look at the Lojong texts and figure out what to meditate on. But that is going to be too late then. You had a question?
I mean, a little bit in the end, it became more clear what you were referring to. But from my European view, I think that the Americans suffer quite a bit. And I hear that so many Americans have to have two or three jobs to sustain their lives, or so many Americans have to rely on food banks, or so many Americans have health problems because they don't get proper health care, and on. And then the cost for education and all that there's no social security, that creates so much suffering, physical and mental suffering. I see from the outside there's a lot of hardship, and but maybe some or the majority of people don't want to look at it closely and or can't because they don't have examples.
Right. Yeah. So I didn't mean to ignore the hardship that and the poverty and the suffering that exists in this country. I mean, we all know about it, don't we? But what I was talking about was the ability to endure difficulty. Okay. So some cultures in this country have that ability to endure difficulty. But other cultures, you know, it seems like maybe once you get to be middle class, then you lose that ability to endure difficulty. Yeah. The people who are in a lot of suffering, you know, they have to learn to endure it. But kind of, you know, once people get to middle class, it seems like that becomes more difficult. You know, and especially those of us who were born to families that worked hard to give their kids the American dream, and we got the American dream, but we didn't always appreciate what they had to go through to get it. You know, so we complain when it's threatened. Yeah, but you're absolutely right. I mean, there's tons of suffering here.
You're totally right. I can't see really this commonness, you know, that maybe a German or other countries who have gone through wars, that they may have, because a common experience of war, and not all Americans have the same experiences.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Then, without the conqueror's teaching, okay, so being born in a place where the Buddha's teachings have, where a Buddha has not appeared. Yeah. So, I mean, again, imagine that. You're a human being. You have enough to eat. You have a very good life. But no Buddha has appeared in the historical era in which you live. How are you going to practice? You live your life. You have, you know, access to other philosophies, but you don't have access to the Buddha's teachings. Yeah. Or birth as a barbarian, okay? So a barbarian is kind of like people with wrong views, you know, who are considered uncivilized, uncultured, holding all sorts of strange wrong views. Yeah, we're not born that way. In a border country, yeah, so in an area where maybe the Buddha has appeared, but there's no teachings there. Or, you know, birth as a barbarian, yeah? It could be in a country where science is very, not science is good, where scientific reductionism is prominent, or a country where communist doctrine was very prominent, where, you know, there's no way you could meet the Dharma or practice it, even if you did meet it. Okay. And then it says being deaf and dumb. the idea, I don't think is so much being deaf and, you know, not being able to hear and not being able to speak. I think the meaning is having physical or mental interferences that inhibit us from learning and practicing. Okay? So it could include people who are very seriously mentally ill, who are hallucinating all the time, or somebody who's fried their mind on drugs and can't think straight, or, you know, very severe physical limitations, so they couldn't listen to teachings or practice, these kinds of things. In ancient times, it used to be people who were blind and deaf. But now we have Braille, we have sign language, yeah? So I don't think that the thing of being blind and deaf is quite the same degree of hindrance as it was in ancient times before Braille and sign language, yeah? Because now, those people get along quite well, and, you know, their intelligence really comes out and they can contribute to society. Okay, so those are the eight freedoms from Letter to a Friend, okay? And, there's one more. it was in the next verse. And birth as a long life god. Okay, being born as any of these. Okay, so a barbarian in a border country is one. Being deaf and dumb is one. And then birth is a long life god. So this is a perceptionless god. They are born in the form realm, somewhere in the form realm. But the thing is, with this kind of god, they only have, like, consciousness. They're so deep into their meditative state that they only have a moment of conscious awareness when they're born and when they die. So the rest of the time, they're spaced out in their samadhi. And so clearly, again, that's rather pleasant. You're not experiencing gross suffering, but you have no opportunity to study or practice the Dharma. Okay, so you can't develop the three wisdoms of study, reflection, meditation if you have these kind of hindrances in your life. Okay, so it says being born as any of these eight is called being born without freedom. Having found freedom free from those, strive to become free from birth. Okay. So don't just say, oh, I'm so glad I wasn't born that way, but do something useful with the state that you have and try and be free of cyclic existence. And so then he's going to go into the 10 fortunes. But first, a question.
Someone says, can't we be experiencing some or all of the realms during this lifetime on Earth?
Mm. So that question comes up a lot. And many teachers describe these realms as states that people can experience as human beings. But, and that's useful for getting an idea, but this is meant, these different realms are meant to be taken literally. And when you are born in them, your experience is as real as ours is right now, because we are born in one of the six realms. We're born in the human realm. Okay? So whatever realm you're born into, yeah, the karmic appearance of that realm is so strong that is your reality. So there may be, you know, similarities with beings in other realms, but these realms are as real as our human realm is. Okay. And some people have trouble with that, you know, thinking about that. But, you know, we have an expression in English when somebody's acting really horribly, we say they're acting worse than an animal. Now, if somebody acts worse than an animal, how far is it from that mental state to when they die being born as an animal? Yeah? So you could have that similar mental state now and acting accordingly and then have that kind of rebirth in the future. Okay. So then the 10 endowments, so the 8 came from Nagarjuna's letter to a friend. The 10 endowments are from Shravaka Bhumi, the hearer's grounds. And who wrote that?
Asanga.
Okay. So here it's the 10 freedoms. The 10 fortunes. There's 5 that are said to pertain to oneself, and then 5 that pertain to society. Okay. So the ones pertaining to self, first, we're born human. So that's good news. Yes, human beings have a lot of suffering, but we have human intelligence. Yeah. And human intelligence is something that is lacking in the other realms. Now, the question is, how do we use our human intelligence? Okay. If we use our human intelligence well, we can attain Buddhahood. If we don't use our human intelligence well, we build bigger and better bombs and kill each other and inflict pain and torture on each other much better. Okay, so human intelligence is an incredible freedom, an incredible blessing, but alone it's not sufficient because it can be abused and bring great damage. Not only to others, but also to ourselves. If we misuse our human intelligence, we create a ton of, you know, destructive karma that will send us to the actual lower realms in the future. If you wonder how people create that kind of karma, read the newspaper. Yeah? Look at what people are doing and how they treat other people. Look at what some politicians are doing, what some business people are doing. What is the motivation behind many of those actions? And they may do actions that get themselves wealth and power for a time in this life, but the amount of negative karma they create because of that is a fast train to a lower rebirth at the time of death. So don't get fooled by people who are rich and famous and powerful in this life, because it's just a karmic result. If they use it well to benefit others and to create virtue, then they will have a good wealth and a good rebirth and society benefits. But if they don't use their inhuman intelligence well and instead act with greed and anger and spite and so on, they're not only inflicting pain on others right now, but creating the cause for their own lower rebirth. And the thing is, they don't even know that they're doing this. There's no awareness of karma and its effects. So they think they're on top of the world, and they don't realize what causes they are creating for the kind of future they're going to experience. And that's a real tragedy, you know? If you know at least something about karma, then maybe, you know, you will try and refrain from some negativities. But if you don't know anything about karma and you don't even believe in heaven and hell from another religion, then it's like anything goes. as long as I can get what I want when I want it and not get caught, go for it. Yeah. And, you know, the tragedy is not only they're causing suffering to others, but what they're doing to themselves. Yeah. So it reminds me when I was on pilgrimage in China many years ago, we were at some chai shop out in the middle of nowhere. And on the wall, they had a picture of the Gang of Four. And this was after the Gang of Four had been dispersed and whatever happened to them, which was not so good. But my Chinese friends looked at it and said, oh, these people are all in different realms now. So they were once rich, powerful, famous in the human realm. Yeah, then life ends, gone. Yeah. And, you know, when we're in our next rebirth, we can't go, but don't you realize that I'm so-and-so from my previous life and I had a high status then? Don't you realize I was president of this and that? Don't you realize I was a zillionaire? Don't you realize who I was in my past life? So you can't treat me like that now that I'm born as a gopher or as a hell being. You know, what are you going to say in your next life? Nobody cares who you were in your previous life. And you probably won't even remember, because the karmic vision of your new life will be so strong, you'll be totally immersed in it. Yeah. So, no. Yeah. So we are free of that right now. My goodness. That's quite a fortune, isn't it? Yeah. To have the kind of human intelligence that can read and understand and think about the teachings, ask questions. Okay, human, central born. We're born in, well, I wasn't born in a central land. Yeah, when I was born, America was not a central land. It was one of these border areas with the barbarians, you know. And so this is the importance of us doing the Vinaya rites of Posada and Varsa and Pravarana, because having a sangha of four fully ordained monks or nuns, doing these three rites and living as a community makes the land a central land, meaning that there is a place where you can go to learn the Dharma. Okay? It's not four individuals living in four different towns in the same state. It's four individuals living together, creating a place where other people know that they can go to learn the Dharma. Okay. So we're living in a central country. Complete faculties. Yeah. We have physically, mentally, yeah, our body works reasonably well. Of course, as you age, that doesn't always continue. Yeah, mental faculties work reasonably well. Again, very, very fortunate.
You say that our presence makes this a central land. Does that include Canada? I mean, Canada is closer to us than Florida.
Uh-huh.
So would we be part of...
You know, I've never seen in the scriptures how large it has to be a central land. But I would think if you can easily get here...
With a plane, I can be in Mexico in 6 hours. Is that close enough?
Yeah, I don't know. You do some research. Maybe it's in the Abhidharma. You can look up and see what it says. But the measurements will be in Pakse. They won't be in miles or kilometers. Okay. So human beings, central land, a complete faculties. And then it says not having transgressed the limits of karma. So this means not having committed one of the five heinous actions, okay? Killing your mother, killing your father, killing an arhat, shedding the blood of a Buddha, and causing schism in the Sangha. So we haven't done those kinds of things. But now, in countries where they're talking about legalizing euthanasia, you have to be careful about that. Because one of your parents may want assisted suicide. And, you know, if you do it, you may think you're being compassionate, but it's still taking life. Yeah. So in saying that, we're not saying people have to live until they die naturally. Let them suffer from the pain. We're not going to alleviate that because that's killing. Okay, that's not what we're saying. Okay, we're saying that incredible pain nowadays, quite fortunately, can be mediated by drugs. Yeah, so if you have access to some kind of drugs, that can mediate it. And also, from a Buddhist viewpoint, your human life has value even if, you know, you're physically ill or injured or, you know, mentally maybe not everything is functioning well, but something is functioning well. You know, you can still make your life meaningful. When I lived in Singapore, I was helping one young man. He was in his early 30s. He had just been accepted to Tulane University. And when you're in Singapore and you get to go to a foreign university, you are on top of the world. And he had cancer. And so he was not going to be able to go. And he was getting weaker and he was dying. So I was helping with that. Not helping him die, but helping him deal with the situation. So one day we were sitting in the flat and looking out the window and, you know, he was saying, I'm just a useless person. Look at me. I can't do anything. I'm sitting here and dying. And I said, look down, because he was, I don't know, 10th, 11th floor. I said, see all those people in their cars running around? Yeah. Do you think that their lives are more valuable than yours? You don't know what they're doing in their lives. Are they thinking about Dharma or are they thinking about how to fulfill their greed or how to retaliate against somebody who harmed them? I said, you know the Dharma and you can think about the Dharma and your life is still meaningful. Yeah. Even if you're weak, even if you can't go out and get a job and do something. And he was very much thinking about the Dharma during, you know, that whole period as he was dying. Yeah. He was the one at the very end who reminded his sister to give offerings to the Sangha before he died. Yeah. So sometimes I wonder if I'm going to meet him again, you know, because we had some kind of close karmic connection. There were two young men when I lived in Singapore. It was the first time when I lived there. And they were both dying of cancer and very strong karmic connections with both of them. So I kind of wonder, you know. Anyway, I don't have the power to recognize them, even if they turn up.
If you kill your mother or father, what is the hindrance that brings it with it? I mean, I can imagine it brings a lot of mental hindrances.
Rebirth. They say with the five heinous actions, you go straight to the hell realms. You know, there's no time hanging out in the bardo or taking any other rebirth. You know, it's like in Monopoly, you know, do not pass go, do not collect $200. You're going. So it's serious, you know. The good thing is it can be purified. Yeah. In the Mahayana tradition, we say even that kind of serious karma can be purified. Yeah. But even if you can't enter the Sangha, you practice as a good layperson. Yeah. And we need good lay practitioners who are sincere and who practice well.
And about drawing the blood of an arhat, so, or is it killing an arhat?
It's killing an arhat.
So that has to be done with a bad motivation, right?
Yeah. It's, I don't think it's, you know, you get in a car accident or something like that. No, all these things are things that are done with a deliberate, conscious, horrible motivation.
Makes total sense to me that Yun His Holiness put refuge in the middle scope, and that the relating to a spiritual mentor goes somewhere else. And I've always been thinking about the lower realms in the initial scope, because that can get people, especially Westerners, just so bent out of shape.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And would that also be better in the middle scope? Okay. Or maybe at some point you just have to deal with it anyway, right?
Yeah. Well, in the Library of Wisdom and Compassion, we put it toward, you know, in the initial one, but mentioned it just very briefly. But it does come in the middle scope. We didn't go into it in a lot of depth there either, but it does come, because in the middle you're trying to be free of all of samsara. Yeah. But, you know, talking about the mind and rebirth is necessary before even thinking about other realms. Yeah. So we tried to do that a lot. But it's very interesting, the talk about the different realms. Some Westerners go, wow, I get that. That makes sense. And some people go, don't tell me about that. I don't want to hear it, especially the hell realms. This is why I left Christianity, you know, because they were threatening me with going to hell if I wasn't a good kid. And I'm sick of that. And, you know, so in Buddhism, it's very important to understand nobody is threatening us with going to hell. And nobody is sending us to hell. You know, the idea of reward and punishment for good and bad behavior is not there in Buddhism. It's not that kind of thing where there's somebody external who set up the rules, who then gives you rewards and punishments. That idea fits in a theistic religion. It does not fit in Buddhism, because the Buddha does not have the power to send us to upper and lower realms. And if the Buddha did have the power, he would definitely not send us to the lower realms. Okay. What creates the lower realms? What creates the upper realms? Our mind, our karma. Okay. So our mind is the source of our experience. And that's why taming our mind is so important. So we're not trying to follow the rules that somebody else made up. And we're not trying to please somebody else so that they don't punish us. Because nobody's punishing us. And nobody's rewarding us. We don't have to brown nose up to some powerful somebody or something. Okay? We create our own experience. So that is good news, because then we have the power to do something good. It's also bad news, because then we can't blame anybody else. But I think the good news outweighs the bad news, because the good news of being able to, you know, create the kind of future that we want to have, that is a lot of power, you know. And if we use that well, and, you know, we can become fully awakened Buddhas. It's there, Yeah. So don't get all hung up on somebody punishing you. That's not what's going on. Alex once told me he had someone come and say to him, you know, in Christianity there's hell, in Buddhism there's hell. I'm afraid if I'm a Buddhist, then I'll go to Christian hell for being a heretic. But if I'm a Christian, then I'll go to Buddhist hell for not believing in the three jewels. And it's like, no, this is not what it's all about. That's not what's going on. Relax. Nobody's sending you to hell and heaven for being a heretic. You know, you figure out what you believe in and you live your life with values that make sense to you, that you've checked out, and, you know, make your life meaningful and do something good. Yeah, and don't worry about somebody sending you to heaven or hell. That's not going to happen. Okay, but this, you know, if you were raised as a kid with that kind of view, you have to spend a lot of time in your meditation undoing that view and thinking about karma and how karma works and really thinking about the qualities of the Buddha and how karma works and that nobody is punishing and nobody is rewarding. And you have to think about it again and again and again, because as a kid, sometimes, you know, what they tell you, you're innocent, it goes in, and you have to undo it, undo that conditioning. So it's like breaking a bad habit, you know? But if you put the energy in, you can let go of all that conditioning. Because it's only conditioning. It's not reality. And that's what's important, you know. You're not rejecting reality. You're rejecting some old conditioning that is not reality. Okay. And developing a self-confidence that will enable you to really make your life meaningful and do a lot of good in the world. Okay.